Michael Tesarian is not a stranger to mystery, as he is one of the preeminent researchers in the field of the occult and the subject of the earthly origins of what we call evil, which he says is not inherent to the human species. According to Michael, perhaps one of the greatest remaining mysteries is the lost civilization known as Atlantis. Some say it was a continent. Some say it was a city. Michael says it was there that a species of beings from another planet that had been laid to waste, fled to, and colonized. He goes on to explain in his book Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation, that the progeny of those beings have been in control of our governments, religions, educational systems, and financial institutions for thousands of years. I spoke with Michael about Atlantis and what lies ahead for mankind. Michael, thank you for joining me today. I know you're a very busy man, and I can't tell you how impressed I am with the body of research that you have managed to put together. It's truly magnificent. You seem to have drawn on every single ancient text, document, and wisdom out there. So clearly this is a lifetime endeavor. So we're going to start the story today with purpose about the subject of Atlantis and how some of the beings that many feel may be manipulating forces on our planet today may have made entry here. Is that okay with you to begin at that point?
Yeah, sure.
All right. Let's just launch into it. Your story starts with the destruction of a planet, in part, known as Tiamat and by other names as well. Can you just pick up the story and tell us what happened to this planet as a result of disaster somewhere else?
Well, a lot of people have, not a lot, but at certain times of history, there's been great scholars who've understood that by looking at the fossil record, by studying, the myths and legends of the ancient world, and of course my mind goes immediately to people like Emanuel Velikovsky, but there's been plenty of others, that there was significant upheaval on this planet, and so it's kind of in the subculture. Certainly even some scientists have accepted that something is not quite right with the Darwinian picture and the normal, geological idea. But the only thing is that, right the way up to Zachariah Sitchin and most of the alternative students, and scholars, they're normally thinking that this was some sort of natural event, meaning that it was either volcanism on Earth, it was a torrential rain, just like the myths are saying, that, you're dealing with a flood situation. There's plenty of evidence for that. Or, more brave sort of speculators will say, this was a comet. And this ties into the whole concept of the careering comet, which was known as Phaeton. Mm-hmm. And all the evidence from the mythologies that show that some body, careering body, came into our solar system and basically smashed into the planets and caused havoc. And that is now, accepted that this possibility can happen. Zachariah Sitchin has shown that the Sumerian seals are literally drawing it out for you. Completely clearly mentioning in great detail, at great length, that this happened. The difference with my work is that I do not subscribe to the fact that the upheavals, the devastation, the cataclysm was natural. My take on it is actually pretty revolutionary in the sense that there was a large planet in our solar system, which has been known as Lucifer or Rahab or Tiamat. The name is really not important, like Marduk. In ancient times, it was even called Luna.
Mm-hmm.
And, at one point, not connected to the name of our moon. So there's every mythology, every school, has sort of different reports about this. But the destruction of this planet, which was a key part of our solar system, wasn't not, in my opinion, due to any careering comet. It was actually incinerated or destroyed by technology, by warring factions that had basically their particular conflict in another part of the universe had strayed into our area. And this is what is known as the coming of the gods, because even though we know there was a cataclysm, there was upheaval, there is this cometary action that took place, or there is this heavenly, upheaval that has left its scars. You're talking about, you got the asteroid belt up there. You got Bode's Law that says there's a missing planet. It's obvious. You've got the rings of Saturn, which are artificial. They're created from the debris, not just natural debris of the cosmos, but also from debris from within our solar system of the ruined planet. My take, though, is, again, that it's just not nature doing this. This was actually precipitated by the gods, what people were calling the gods. That's basically the difference there.
Let's look at what happened then in the time of Atlantis. There are many different versions of what happened prior to Atlantis, from Lemuria, an ancient place known as Atlantea, various explosions due to technology. There are many, many different stories that have been, you know, propagated at this point in time. But I would like to really isolate your perception of what happened starting in the time of Atlantis, which, am I correct in understanding that that's when you believe the more negative influence really began exerting itself and showing up here on this planet?
Yeah, that's precisely correct. You know, evil, injustice, immorality, barbarity, you know, malevolence, these have a date of birth. And we're dealing with some major fallacies, major league fallacies from, you know, university schools, think tanks, all the educational orbs trying to tell us that, you know, there was no such thing as pre-diluvian civilizations. It all just begins, you know, 7 to 11,000 years ago. We got the fallacy of the evil, or that this proclivity within human beings for sadism and, you know, violence and brutality is, you know, that's age old. It's millions of years old. It's part of nature. It's built into the psyche, you know. We're dealing with fallacies regarding that
yes.
All civilization comes from the Greeks, the Romans, and the Jews. You know, I mean,
right.
And luckily, I'm not complaining. I'm just, because actually, I'm optimistic because, you know, out of the 10 or, you know, 5 to 10 major glaring fallacies that have been put before us in the last 100 years since the science of history began, the study of history, most of them are now actually being shattered. You know, not maybe from within the officialdom of academia, but they are being very much questioned now by new discoveries. But your question focuses on one of the most crucial of all, you know, questions, and it's something that I pretty much am alone in asking within the ufology field or within the field of conspiracy or whatever you want to call it. You know, I just have never left consciousness at the door, and that's why my message is kind of in one way, you know, been strongly welcomed, which is good because, but, you know, I was kind of peeved that people had not asked this before. You know, I wasn't really, it's in one way, it's almost not, you know, a good thing that, you know, my work was distinguished by talking about the philosophical, you know, questions of evil, you know, because I'm shocked that, you know, people have not been having this question.
Right, and it is a very interesting question because, if I may just interject one thing, I know your work is sometimes also compared with David Icke's work and his with yours in certain areas where there are touchstones, and the touchstone you're speaking about right now, this notion of evil, is it intrinsic to mankind? I think in that place, the two of you share an opinion, no, this is not necessarily intrinsic to this beautiful experience of Earth itself, but something was introduced, almost like a virus.
Yeah, you couldn't have used a better term, because this is the theme of the last chapter of the book, in which I liken the coming of evil as exactly that, you know, the penetration of a foreign body, like an inoculated off-world, you know, virus that has absolutely driven man to despair. You know, these eight fallen angels we're talking about, of course, genetically interfered with us, so the actual root of what we're talking about is the genetic interference with the human being that introduced proclivities within the human psyche, that traumatized the human psyche. So it's a combination of several levels of trauma, three specifically. One was the actual visitation of these beings, and then before they got to this Earth, they'd already, you know, participated in the destruction of a planet. That was actually witnessed, as the myths and legends are quite clearly telling you. This was witnessed from the Earth, the upheaval, and people thought, you know, the gods are angry, what on Earth is going on? So they were traumatized from that. When the Atlanteans finally got here and began their sort of, you know, Planet of the Apes experimentation, where they literally did these transgenic experiments, that is the most significant, again, violation of psychic and spiritual sovereignty. It's a biological infraction that caused unmitigated, you know, indescribable physical, biological, and mental somatic trauma. And then, subsequently, if people are familiar with my work, we talk about the pole shift, you know, and then these great floods and destruction. So we're talking about three. And, you know, obviously there's so many other satellite traumas, but the three ones that I've identified have such a huge impact, it's a miracle that the human being has survived with any kind of sanity.
That is very true, because it seems outside of indigenous cultures, all of the, quote, developed cultures, unquote, have bought into one form of religion or another that really places a high premium on evil. We must repent of our sins, as though guilty until proven innocent, which I personally do not buy into.
No, but you see, once man has bought the lie that he in some way was responsible for angering the gods, then he becomes bound utterly to rituals to try and offset the same thing again.
And religion sprang up as a result of that, did they not?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, religion is the offset. Once you're dealing with a highly psychotic, traumatized ego, you know, in fact, the ego, I believe, took birth in the aftermath of these traumas. The ego is actually, it's very ambivalent, as the ego is ambivalent, because one side of the ego in its earliest days was a good thing, because the ego in its earliest incarnation was the very thing that saves consciousness from complete and total collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been looked into by Terence McKenna and also by Julian James, even though they haven't drawn as broad a conclusion as I would have liked. What we're talking about here is a spastic muscle. Just in the same way that a human being would trip and fall, a muscle will contract very tightly to try and save you from falling. This is what happened collectively with a collective trauma that still most Western scientists haven't the faintest idea. They've seen the symptoms of it. They know that something exists within the racial memory that's not wholesome. But they don't, you know, they're too timid to draw the conclusion and say, wait a minute here, we're talking about a collective, wholesale collapse of consciousness. Consciousness, as we know it, was fragmented beyond description. But out of that came this energetic reaction, like a muscle is a physical reaction, but within the brain, within the mind, within the psyche of a human being collectively came a spasm or reaction that basically was a hardening, an immediate hardening of consciousness into what we now refer to as the ego. So the birth of the, and that's why the ego is so proud and, you know, and so unbelievably, you know, yang and masculine. It's because
and protective and isolationist.
Yes, all of those things. It's just like, you know, the manager at the top of the skyscraper who does, he wants the crown because he did a great service for mankind and now it's gone to his head. So we have to thank the ego, but we're also trapped now in the web of its own making. And you know, this is a great mythological, it's such a tremendous, I mean, even the movie Vanilla Ice, you know, this is still even a concept that is used in some of the great art of the world, is that you have the ego and you've got what the ego has created, but is there anything outside of that matrix? And should you want to escape it, could you do it? Because who's even the thinker within the mind, you know? So you go, it goes into all this other psychology. But to get back to what you were saying, the idea that evil... that the religions who co-opted this concept is when a very guilty, very traumatized human being who's seen the world, the pillars of the world crash, but who has in fact survived miraculously in all of this mayhem, he is now in a state that is so far removed. Basically, in short, what has happened is that the umbilical connection to the matrix, to the direct, to the goddess, to the mother, to that energy bank, that you know, the natural archive of the true brain, or the whole brain, or the holarchy, has now been warped in actually it's been cut in most, and it's been warped in others, and it's terribly tangled in other people. And for the most of the people, it doesn't even exist at all. When you are now so existentially isolated, just like, you know, a community on some island out there, and you know, in Argentina, the Falkland Islands, or something, when you're now so isolated, you are completely traumatized. You forget that you're traumatized. You end up, you know, thinking that your traumatic life is normal, so you don't. As time passes, you exist in a certain flight or fight mentality. You exist in a traumatized, narrow, provincial, sadistic, masculinistic, phallocratic way, and you think it's perfectly normal because that's another, you know, strange quirk of the mind, is that it doesn't notice its own malady. But the fact of the matter is that the religions come in because man then needed to cling to something when he really had lost his umbilical direct connection to the world matrix, in which there was no need for priests necessarily. You had instructors, but there was no need for any of this hierarchical institutions, which had you as the sinner at the bottom, and you know, all the rituals that you had to participate in the way, in order to now win back the favor of Yahweh, or whatever sort of hokamania that people have fallen into. So the original motives psychically for an emotional connection to God and all of this stuff is born out of very, very physical traumas and quandaries that happened in the blink of an eye historically ago. So we're still reeling from the shock. The earth is still reeling from the shock of the cataclysm, and the human mind is still reeling from the shock of the traumata. It is not an old story. So even when you look on the media today and you see the serial killers, you see the mega death, You see the war. You see the incredible abuses of nature. All of it, all the misogyny, you know, those now need to be, my work, you know, basically tries to frame all of that and say, we understand what is happening here, but can we frame it as to why these mad, crazy people are running around doing what they're doing? Is we're dealing with a traumatized animal here, who's very, very far removed, you see, from the central oracle of truth.
So how did, going from Atlantean times, who were these beings that came in predominantly, I mean, in my understanding, there were many types of beings that did come, and some to help, but then others not to help. And we're maybe seeing the effects of those beings today, and perhaps even the remaining presences of those particular beings that we now want to be out from under the influence of. Can you talk about that particular strain of being that you've dedicated, you know, some time to in your studies?
Well, the Nephilim, you know, called the Anunnaki or whatever, I don't know about other beings. I don't focus that on my work, though I do know that the theory exists. I only focus on just one specific group.
Exactly.
Called the 200, quote-unquote, you know, and the legends, in the Irish legends, they're mentioned also, you know, one of the names for them in Irish legends is the Fomori, which means the men from below the ocean or beneath the water, you know, or the strong ones, whatever. Anunnaki representing, you know, those from above. You have the term Nephilim, mm-hmm. which is a very ambiguous term that has been used in many, I mean, every word, like just in a normal dictionary today, you know, words have two or three different meanings, so it's not just one meaning. So when people read my book, you know, I'm using the word Nephilim in one particular, you know, permutation, but there are two to three other permutations. Really, the word only meant scientist or really intelligent being, mm-hmm. you know, but of course it carried the connotation of those from above, those who, the heavenly serpents, the heavenly ones who have come down here.
Mm-hmm.
But specifically, it meant those who were specially endowed. These were members that later, after the War of the Gods, the bloodline, now that everybody had been genetically, you know, manipulated by these people, then they kept a bloodline. Now you were honor bound to keep, you know, very distinct bloodline records of who was connected to whom, you know, with the Atlantean strain, the Lemurian strain. And we have what's called the Dragon Court that even people like Lawrence Gardner speak about. Certainly the author William Bramley has
yes.
done fantastic work on that. So we're talking about here the dragon bloodline is descended from the dragons, the serpents, not because they look like serpents, but because Nahash, or the words for serpent, represented scientists, people of highly great, you know, technical ability.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even debatable whether or not they did have a sense of, you know, spiritual dimension. You know, I don't think they did, but, you know, who knows? We're talking post-trauma. We're talking post-visitation, so it's very difficult to know. It might have been that the mere tampering with the DNA caused man to be a schizoid creature. But these beings, you know, there's something wrong in their psyche from the very fact that they interfered. So, you know, I can't attribute the term positive or good to these people because, you know, the very fact of the breaching of the destiny, I mean, they've interfered not just with the destiny of one little community or one little person. They have utterly changed the course of the river of destiny for the whole human race by messing with their DNA. And man has been suffering the consequences. He's gendered, you know, he's got gender dysphoria. He has an absolute antipathy towards nature. His mind has barely got the reason to be able to, you know, distinguish between all the lies that is disseminated from on high. The descendants of these Nephilim are still operating from behind, you know, the seats of government. So we've got some major, you know, quandaries here. So the people who initiated all of that kind of thing cannot be, in any sense of the imagination, be considered positive.
Yeah,
and
yes.
And two schools of thought, just like in Arthurian legends, they talk about the two colleges, the two dragons, the conflict of the two serpents. You're now going to, and the Caduceus of Hermes shows you literally the two, you know, the opposing powers. Many myths and sagas talk about it. So you're dealing with this concept and of the antagonism between two contingents. As psychologists, or just let's say pseudo-psychologists, people who come along later misinterpreting the legends go, oh, that's just stories about man's higher self and his lower self. And they're not wrong. I mean, it is one dimension of that meaning, yeah, is that man is in conflict with aspects of his own nature. But we got to realize that that didn't just come about some existential, you know, sort of quandary. This is based in an actual factual event, a historic. It's amazing to me that people can't make that simple leap. They're willing to accept it's just all happening within the psyche as part of God's plan or nature did it. Three most preposterous, you know, kind of understandings.
Mm-hmm.
But they can't get their mind around the very simple fact that a physical trauma, a physical invasion, a physical, you know, cataclysm could have done it. when all the physical geological evidence is right there? I mean, it's
can we talk about that for a moment? Because in virtually every ancient text, and also certainly in indigenous tribes, it has always been accepted that there were those who came in, whether they were called chariots or vessels or balls of fire or whatever, from the sky, have been here for a very long time now. So the existence of beings coming from above seems to be well documented enough that that's really not worth debate anymore. So what did they do when they got here? What do you feel the intention was from your research?
Well, it basically is like three levels. First, they were hiding because they were being pursued, as I said. So I think that they were hiding for a period of weeks or months, or, you know, we really can't know when it comes to timing how long any of these things lasted. It's just sketchy. But the idea is that they had concealed themselves on Earth. They came to Earth to conceal themselves from those who were following them. So there was a period of concealment and, of course, normal adjustment to this planet. The planet might have been smaller than the ones that they've known. You know, the ultraviolet light is different. The whole planet had little, no oceans. I connect that the oceans came from the subsequent disasters later on. So there's going to be difference. And then don't forget that the trauma, the cataclysm that destroyed the Tiamat, the after effects of that have affected the Earth. So the Earth is not even in a healthy state because, like many planets in the solar system, its magnetic field, you see, and its atmosphere was highly disturbed. So there would have been a time of tremendous upheaval, mm-hmm. not just from the face of the Earth, but from the Nephilim themselves. But they made quick, after they realized that they were safe, instead of flying off or trying to get away, they actually remained on this planet. And they then start, as subsequent centuries went by, basically like the British government have, colonies all over the world. The Atlantean colony started, the Atlantean pattern started. Atlantis not being an island itself, Atlantis was like a city-state or city or some sort of, you know, civic center on a continent. So a lot of people have disinformation when they think of Atlantis as a specific island itself. It was not. It was a colony of these Atlanteans on a great continent that used to exist in the North Atlantic. That's Britain and Scandinavia and the Arctic and also Iceland and Greenland were probably part of this big, enormous continent that has since broken up. On that continent, the second thing they did was that they started building Atlantis, what we know today to be that great civilization. And they started to corral indigenous people of the Earth there to study, you know, they were studying the fauna and the flora. Again, being scientists, they would have done this. And the negative side, of course, is the fact that they then started to use these people as slaves. They wanted them, just like the Popol Vuh says, they wanted servants to rule, to mine and to do the ore, you know, and just generally to be the dog's bodies. And when they couldn't find the perfect servant, they basically then created one in the laboratories with the technology that they had. And this is, you know, comes from a reading of some remarkable stuff in mythology about cybernetics and super technology and super weaponry and just the malignancy of these beings, that they then start to interfere and created the slave race.
Well, now in your book you refer to one line of species known as Homo Atlantis. Where does this come in?
Well, that's just my term for the creature that they first created.
Right, okay.
So it stands in the place of Homo sapiens, because
right.
Sapiens means wise one. Well, you only need to look around. You know, you don't see too much wisdom in Homo sapien. So, and Homo sapien, what we have walking around now, and possibly even Cro-Magnon man, and maybe even Neanderthal man, these are very, very bizarre creatures in the anthropological hominid record. They stand out like a sore thumb, you see. So I believe that those three entities were genetically tampered with.
Yes, I believe so, too. Mm-hmm. So here we have a confluence of supposedly much more advanced beings who've made their way here, now beginning to join with what are known as the Neanderthals. And is this what you call the species that was known as, that you refer to in your terms as Homo Atlantis? Atlanteans?
No, we are. That's actually incorrect. What happened was, it's almost correct. What happened was that the first generation, the first Mark I human that they made was Homo Atlantis. That's correct. And Homo Atlantis, though, had one thing that we don't have, and that is very, very developed intelligence, because when they crossed the DNA, they crossed the DNA that was pure, and therefore Homo Atlantis was unadulterated. He had the best of what the human being had, which I believe was, you know, humanity and love and a strong spiritual connection. And he also had the high, unadulterated, clear, clean, logic, intelligent circuitry, you know, that his masters had, these warlocks of Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
We were second, or a Mark II creation that's called Adamic. You know, just for want of a term, we have to borrow some terms from here and there, but just to make the point clear. So the Adamic man, meaning the Adams and the Eves, were the same thing as Homo Atlantis, but with one distinct difference, and that is that they were dumbed down.
Dumbed down, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some way, you know, the centers of intelligence, I mean, they can do this. They can sit you in a chair in a laboratory around 15 minutes, dumb you down with a couple of probes in your brain. Think what these people could have done with the knowledge of the genome and the knowledge of DNA. So it's possible. And the ancient legends talk about this, that the nakedness, and in my work I translate nakedness as being not physical nakedness, but psychic nakedness, intellectual, mental nakedness, meaning the perfect slave. They kind of made a mistake with Homo Atlantis Mark I because he was an intelligent being and wouldn't serve them. And the Homo Atlanteans left Atlantis and moved to and formed their own civilization on Oceania that we know better as Lemuria. This splitting. So this is what the first revolution, the first revolutionaries, the first rebels were what we would know as the Lemurian race. And this was a matriarchal order of these hybridized beings. So let's understand that they were hybridized. These were people who were very, very endowed.
Yes.
And they
yes.
would be what, you know, were called the great blonde gods, or, you know, of all the world, these kinds of spectacular beings. And their bloodline also continued as well. Even though the original types have passed away, these people also spawned Lemurian descendants. And that bloodline, that DNA, is existing in many, many people. These are the
yes.
people who question. These are the people who rebel. These are the geniuses. These are the sensitives. These are
right.
And people
right.
who dream and have an understanding that something crazy was going on this planet, and that, you know, the corporatization just isn't happening. It's not giving me the securities that I feel like, and I think this has got to go. Well, that comes from somewhere. We sit in our bedrooms and, you know, think we're malcontented. It's just my little depression, my little problem. We have no idea of the kind of rebellions that went on this planet, the spiritual warfare that took place, you know, the incredible commitments. But when we go to literature and when we go to, you know, the movies and we see, you know, the great conflicts between, like, Sherlock Holmes and Professor Moriarty, or, you know, Star Trek with Kirk and Khan, or, you know, Robin Hood with the Sheriff of Nottingham, or Horus with Seth, you know, we are actually, you know, Jesus with Satan, you know, whatever. We are looking there at a drama, a performance that is actually so much more elaborate, that goes right back into the race DNA. And this is, you know, a mythology that never, ever leaves us. It's there. And it's because of the original antagonism that, again, was a blink of an eye ago. This is not a long time ago that this stuff is happening.
Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, I just lost you for a sec. Okay, go ahead.
No, as I said, this is, you know, something that is not...
Right, it's not that far removed from us in chronological dating, right?
No,
that's what you're saying.
Not at all. It's like yesterday in historical terms. Absolutely yesterday. Like.
Let's bring it forward to today. So let's say now you have the essentially Homo Atlantis Lemurian strain. These are the beings who are asking the questions. These are the beings who are beginning to wake up. I think this is the whole issue, is that we have been asleep at the wheel, while the ones who may not have had the best interest of the people and the resources and the planet itself at heart have been awake enough to manipulate things for quite a long time now. Can you talk about bringing history forward from that point until now, how this is essentially showing itself in modern culture on both sides, what the dilemma is, and then let's move toward the end of our time together here today toward what you expect to see happen in terms of the writing of this?
Well, you're right about the manipulation, because, you know, these are foreign visitors to our planet Earth, our perfume garden, and they have no love for, you know, the planet. They have no love for us. They certainly also suffered the trauma of the Earth changes that they precipitated, but they were quick to, you know, re-establish the empires later on in the post-Diluvian world. And after the Flood, they got busy. My work shows that their technology was destroyed, so the reason why there's a big delay, and why you and I are talking about this, you know, at least 13,000 years later, is because there was a big delay. This is what, again, a lot of authors in this field do not deal with, this problem factor of, wait a minute, how come we're still arguing about this? And how come good and evil is still existing side by side? Well, it's because of the fact that there was a delay, and that delay involved the geological Earth changes that took place. But when these beings then, you know, changed mankind's lifestyle, that was more maybe a nomadic, you know, I hate to use the word hunter-gatherer, but again, figuratively, whatever kind of connection that, you know, man had before to nature and the way he lived, it was utterly changed by the agrarian, agriculturalistic, civic kind of, you know, corporate world, and the and this addiction to time and to productivity and all of the kinds of subjugation and territorialization and all of these things that are coming in the historical period, I believe, are based on that old negative Atlantean pattern. And so this was for a reason. This wasn't just because they had nothing better to do. These people had lost their technology. I mean, you know, you've seen in the Superman movies those incredible citadels where the crystals exist, the crystalline computers and that type. You know, if you're talking about people of that much advancement, and believe me, the myths and legends make no bones about it at all. They're talking about immensely, you know, gifted and long-lived and technologically advanced people.
Absolutely.
So if you've lost technology, if it's been destroyed, you are in a real sorry state. And so the only thing that these people had then was the tenaciousness to say, okay, we can mine here, we can mine on this planet Earth, and we can move history forward to the point where we might be able to rebuild a semblance of the technology we lost. And I personally believe that the Renaissance was like a sort of an important milestone, and then of course the Industrial Revolution is a big one, and now we're in the Silicon Age. So we have been literally moving very slowly, like in this timeline, where these individuals are with an age-old occult and also stroke technological agenda. Because in their mind, technology, magic, and science are all mixed into one. But people have never properly, you know, identified why the length of time and what's really going on and how come man seems to take one step forward and 10 steps back, you know, in his development.
Mm-hmm.
It's because you've got a propellant moving you in one direction, so that we're not able to develop these other aspects of our being, the emotional and the psychic side. We're so primitive psychologically, and people just think that's again a quirk of fate. It's not a quirk of fate. It's because you've got people, you know, entities compelling science, compelling civilization in one direction,
mm-hmm.
against all the other beautiful areas that mankind wants to go.
Mm-hmm. Very true. So this shows itself in virtually all of our societal structures. It shows itself in the way our governments are run, our educational system, our fields of medicine, and on and on and on. So now of this, certainly the people that are participating in this are unwitting for the most part. But when you get to the top hand that is more hidden, what's going on there?
Well, this picks up from a very, very important. This is basically the explanation of the next book I'm doing, which will come out in the summer. And this is because one of the most important events after the cataclysm involves Egypt and Ireland. Because remember, if this great continent in the northwest, which was known as the Garden of Hesperides, the original one, Albion, Avalon, you know, you're talking Atlantis here, you're talking Open Athul, Hyperborea. Professor Tolkien referred to it as Numenor. When this great area was destroyed, the elements of civilization from the survivors, you know, moves into Britain, moves into Ireland and England, and also Scandinavia and Scotland, and then from there becomes disseminated out throughout the rest of the world. So we have the rise of the civilizations that are known in Egypt and the Nile.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, because this is key to what you asked. It's from the Nile Valley, another hybrid, another bizarre twist happened in the 18th dynasty of Egypt with the cult of Akhenaten, which again was a dragon bloodline. These were people who were part of the dragon court, so they're already of Atlantean, you know, proclivities or blood, meaning inheritors of some of the knowledge and wisdom that came from those times. But a strange skewed type of spirituality, or which is sun worship, you know, the solar cult, arose in Egypt. And so we're in a situation now in which all that Atlantean malignance or whatever, you know, is ruling our world. And why it's so why it permeates so many of the edifices and institutions of the modern world is because all of those organizations, especially the major political and the educational, medical and governmental, are all controlled by the descendants of this cult of what I call the cult of Aton, coming out of Egypt. The cult of Aton, again, going back to the dragon bloodline, all the way to the Atlantean strain. So there's a connection there between these Egyptian Atlanteans, or Atonists, and the subsequent taking over all of the world. And so terms like New World Order, you see all of these terms that are now bandied around a lot. These are an Egyptian symbolism you see on the American dollar bill. What people in the research community who've been studying these matters need to realize is it's not just a simple story of some evil, you know, secret society, Mason types trying to intrigue, you know, like some sort of super mafia. You know, they got to get that all out of their head. This is a, like David Icke has tracked things back to Babylon. Well, you know, he's on the right track there, because it's not actually to Babylon that the origins come. It's from Atlantis by way of Egypt. Because when the survivors get to Egypt and Egyptian civilization started to get built, you know, we know that that's 32 dynasties long. So I'm not condemning all of Egypt. It's just that at the 18th dynasty.
Well, that's what it is. Yeah, yes, I'm going to, when you finish the statement, I want to ask you something about the 18th dynasty. Go ahead, sorry.
Well, go ahead.
Well, what I'm wondering is this. I mean, if Akhenaten supposedly is known in the historical text as the one who tried to bring, in essence, the notion of worshiping of the sun back into kind of the main reference point. And this is also the same type of reference that we see throughout most indigenous cultures, which is the worship of the source, which is the sun. How does this get translated into the other? Because was that a negative in and of itself as to the objective of Akhenaten's reign?
No, there's a big difference between sun worship and Athenism. And, you know, it's a great question. That goes to the heart of something so very, very important, because there are many properties of light. You know, on the website and in the coming book, I talk about what is light, that light can also conceal as well as reveal. Light can also destroy as well as create. And this goes to the heart of what was going on. For 32 dynasties, for 3,500 years, the worship of light had been very prominent in Egypt, and also in Babylonia, Mesopotamia, Samaria. Mm-hmm. But it was under the auspices of the god Amun-Ra, not Aton. And Amun-Ra and the Amunist priests, who were, you know, the keepers of the wisdom, they were like the druids of Egypt, who kept the understanding of the rulership of light and the meaning of light, never forgot its other side, which is the balancing lunar feminine principles that in Egypt was known by the goddess Mut, M-U-T, who was the counterpart or consort of Amun-Ra. And of course, in all other cultures, you have the goddess figure. And granted, you did in the early Israelites, you had Ash, you know, Asenath, until they dropped her, you know, from the Yahweh concept. So in all proto-mythologies and all proto-traditions, you have the feminine. Atomism, you know, even though women were involved in Atomism, the feminine principle, though, from a theological point of view, was practically non-existent. You're dealing with a skewed understanding of the nature of light. But these people live in an entirely one-season world. When night fell, they thought you were in hell. I mean, you literally, night falling was about the worst thing that could happen to the Atmos, you know? Mm-hmm. There was no underworld cycle, meaning that the dark parts of the psyche, you know, all sorts of yin action was considered, you know, for some bizarre reason, wrong. And I believe that this is the culmination. Atomism is nothing more than the culmination of this old Atlantean, left-brain, super-technological, off-world, you know, ideology. That's what you're seeing. You're seeing the work of the Nephilim, and you're seeing this kind of off-world, nonsensical paradigm in what we call Atomism. There's nothing natural about it. It's not of the Earth. It's Earth-denying. It's underworld-denying. So people are then not, you know, before, when you had Amunism, people were, you know, compelled to look at their dark side of their psyche and to purge and to go through catharsis and to test themselves and to deal with the emotions, you see, and go through rituals. This is all very key part of the Osirian Ammonite policy. And that was a solar cult. That is a solar cult. So it's like this. The best way to describe it is that there is this thing called solar religion, which is like a tree. Ammonism is like the trunk of that tree. And the various solar cults are like the branches. And Atomism is like one twig off one branch. So it's very wrong when you read books and you hear people rambling on about, you know, Atomism, is that Atomism is solar cult worship.
Mm-hmm.
No. They are solar cults. But they are not the. The solar cult is not Atomism,
mm-hmm.
if you get my meaning. So there's mm-hmm. a bigger phenomena, and then there's the one branch that is basically the rotten fruit.
Go ahead.
Well, the bigger problem arises is when you have a lot of Christians who get into this subject, and they mean well, and they try to study it, and they also believe in the God of light and all the rest of it, but they start, you know, idealizing Akhenaten as the founder of monotheism, and he's the guy who was the Christ before the Christ who just did his best to try and get it right and bring enlightenment to humanity. All this malarkey is utterly false. The Ammonite priests of Heliopolis and Giza had been monotheists, believing in Amun-Ra, you see. for aeons. It's just that they understood that light cast a shadow, so you have to have also the light, but you have to accept the darker side of it as well, which is not negative, it's just a pure balanced situation.
So at what point did that become, the lunar become the feminine, and at what point did the fall of the valuing of the feminine occur then? Are you saying that under the Atan cult, so to speak, that they worshipped only the masculine principle of the sun, but then forgot about the feminine principle of the moon, for example?
Yes, to such an extent that one of Akhenaten's wives, his favorite wife called Kia, her full name was Midjonet, which began with M-U-T. The name began with M-U-T, meaning that it was an old pagan name that she had. Her real name was a pagan name representing the goddess Mut. And mostly all names like that that even had a pagan name in it were absolutely taboo. They were abolished. Kia was only able to keep her name of the goddess Mut because, you know, Akhenaten kind of had a soft spot for her, and they kind of turned a blind eye. And that stands out as a very key, one-of-a-kind, you know, and she was a bit stubborn anyway, so she kind of, you know, was never a true Atenist like the rest of them, so she got away with it. But the point being that nobody else got away with it. They were heavy-duty strict on that, and the hardening of Atenism, wasn't really known as anything major before the pharaoh Amenhotep III. And he was kind of a crazy pharaoh. His father was also a bit of a madman, even though, of course, they were great pharaohs. But it was around about the time of Amenhotep III, which is, I think, Akhenaten's father, that then things started to look like there was a major break from the priest of Amun-Ra. But the thing also is that in Egypt, the priests of Amun-Ra were all polytheists and were very, very accommodating and cosmopolitan. All gods of any description could be worshipped in Egypt. That's what it was all about. There was no prejudice. So they tolerated Atenism because they had no idea what this thing was going to do tomorrow. They didn't know it was going to burn down all their churches and temples and abolish it and forbid the worship of every other god. So Atenism to them is just, hey, great, you know, the pharaoh is into another god, he's brought another god to the pantheon. You know, nothing wrong with that. Another aspect of our sun god Amun-Ra, as long as you recognize that Amun-Ra, you know, is the senior god. But there was no heavy-duty, you know, policing or any kind of, you know, hierarchical, insistence in any of this. It was all by human beings' choice. Atenism abolishes that. Atenism abolishes your choice. It abolishes your freedom. You know, it abolishes all the other gods. You know, it is the proto-Christianity. Christians are quite right to look to Atenism or to Akhenaten as the forebearer of their religion. If some people have done that, and certainly even some scholars within Judaism, you know, have done that. I think they're right because there's very, very similar connections. And this comes full circle down to your question. We are living in an Atenist, so we're not just living in a corporate, political, you know, the symbols of state, the symbols of religion, the symbols of government are Atenistic. They're solar symbols, and they're from a particular kind of ideology which wants to make you free by freeing you from freedom. The only freedom that they're going to let people have in this world is the freedom from freedom. And unfortunately, if people are psychologically also subliminally crying out, going, please, government, please, God, or please, whoever, please, you know, the super boss, free me from freedom. I don't know what to do with freedom. You know, I feel anxiety when I have too much freedom. I'm psychically threatened by real freedom. So can you take freedom away from me? Well, then we're going to have these Atenists and we're going to have these government solar worshippers thinking, yep, we'll do that. We're only too happy to free you from freedom.
Well, okay. Now I have another question to add over that, because another anomaly certainly in the artwork of the family of Akhenaten, Nefertiti, and their children, for example, is the unusual shape of their skulls. I mean, this has been up for a lot of debate in terms of what type of being were these beings.
Yeah, I believe that I know all the different theories, and it's, you know, difficult to know which ones are true. I kind of believe that, you know, that of course, I think that they embellished it in the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
I think, especially because, remember, none of the other pharaohs are shown like that. It's only that particular group.
Right.
So there's some kind of real embellishment going on there.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, if you had any thoughts on what that might be.
I've thought about it a lot. See, one of the most dramatic images of Akhenaten that show him almost feminine-like, which has caused a lot of debate. You know, the great Egyptologists have explained that. No problem, you know, like, I can't remember, what's her name? Oh, one of the great Egyptologists who actually discovered the tomb of Nefertiti, Joanne Fletcher, that's her name. Joanne Fletcher's book on Nefertiti will explain a lot of this. she basically says it's because when you see these depictions of the pharaohs, they have commissioned their artists to paint them in the image, not as physical human beings, but in the image of the gods that they worship.
I see.
Meaning as androgynous. So even though you have this penchant, you know, for the masculine son, it was just a normal idiom of Egyptian culture or art, especially in the arts, to try and show that you had matriculated spiritually. Because remember, the pharaoh doesn't just start out at the bottom. The pharaoh is the top boy. He's already gone through all the priesthood. He's already ascended through the whole of the priesthood, you know, and been considered the living god. Now, it doesn't mean you are a living god, and it doesn't mean you are androgynous, but the trappings of state, the trappings of the pharaoh, the image of the pharaoh, how he's worshipped, how he's regarded, his own ego, what he's thinking, all of that is, you know, based on the old pattern that you are an androgynous being who's conquered, you know, good and evil, and you're above the normal sexes, and that you are part of the gods who are sexless or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're depicted, now again, I emphasize, it doesn't mean you really are like that, but the fact of the matter is, if you're depicted in art, they're going to commemorate that. They're going to show you in the aspect of the god, and therefore you're going to look sexless and androgynous, and that's why they kind of embellish the images of Akhenaten. They laid that on very heavily for some reason.
Mm-hmm. And his wife and his children, right.
And his children. And maybe not so much, or could it be quite rightly that these were deformed, you know, what we would call deformed, and deformed doesn't necessarily mean negative. I mean, you know, we know that there's a lot of weird children born and they're put into the backwoods of insane asylums and,
mm-hmm.
and backwoods of hospitals, and there's nothing wrong with them at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because the human beings have a taboo, you know, to weird-looking children.
Right. Well, let's take it from there, from the cult of Aton to into Christianity and up to today and who we are. Who we are.
Well, Christianity, Judaism, as is now being explored, is now being finally coming to light, is a form of optimism, period. I mean, the actual details of that is a quite a lengthy, you know, thing, and that's why I go into it in the book, trying to show how St. Paul was funded by the Akhenists. He was, you know, he was either very affiliated with them or was directly in their pay, and that the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and certainly the occult groups within the Pharisees and Sadducees. So when I talk about these movements, I'm not just talking about your average, you know, it's like when we said about Masons, we're not just talking about your average Mason who lives down the street. So I try to be specific. I'm not saying all the Pharisees or all the Sadducees or all the Romans. But we're talking about here a cult of Aton that was the pharaohs of the world. You don't get more powerful than Akhenaten and the pharaohs of Egypt who ruled the greatest land on the face of this earth. And so even though those people have been disbarred or expelled from their country, you know, they're not wandering around wondering what to be doing. These are people who are welcomed in to other Western and Asian and Eurasian countries. They had many affiliates, many friends in Rome, in Italy, and these people set to work from behind the scenes. They had powerful allies amongst the Sadducees, amongst the Pharisees, amongst even the Essenes. You know, they would have other agents. They were power brokers, very wealthy people who were looked upon in awe. I mean, these aren't just, you know, normal people you're dealing with here. You're dealing with a descendancy that not only has Atlantean blood, who already have reigned as the pharaohs of Egypt. What is Europe compared to that? So when these people, you know, start working behind the Flavians of Rome and the Pisos of Rome, you see, and some of the Herodian family, the study of the family Herod that you may hear mentioned in the Bible,
yes.
And all of their sundry connections and relatives are very interesting. The story of Jesus ties into this. And certainly the founding of Christianity by Paul, later by Constantine. Constantine was a member all his life. The guy wasn't even a Christian. He wasn't made a Christian until after his birth, Regina, after his death. But all his living life, he was a member of a cult called the Saul Invictus cult.
Yes. I read some of that.
Mm-hmm. About Saul Invictus, we're talking Atomism. These guys are members of Egyptoid, Greco-Egyptian mystery cults that are Atomist in nature. They're Mithraic in nature. They're Zoroastrian in nature. They're, you know, these things are infiltrated by Atomistic theory. And then you suddenly have 5 minutes later Christianity being born. You know, this Saul, Paul's name before he was called Paul, and this is because of a disguising factor.
Right, right. It was Saul. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was Saul. Well,
right.
Wait a minute. You can spell Saul, S-A-U-L, if you like, but it's really a take on the word Saul, S-O-L.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yes, so I've read that.
They're telling you one thing with the right hand, but the left hand is saying, hey, chump, let me tell you who's really offering this kind of stuff. The first king of the United Monarchy of Israel is called Saul.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It goes
right.
To Samuel, etc., etc. So
right.
The left telling you this, but they do it in this covert way that, you know, people like myself look into. So Saul is creating Christianity. Then he calls himself Paul. You know, the names and the symbolism is very interesting. Then you find all of this tie into the Flavian and Piso families. I go into this all in the new book, showing you that it's not only Atomism. You know, it was a hybrid, because remember, these Atomists are in disguise. They don't want to be out in the open anymore after losing their precious seats in Egypt and having many, many, many enemies who also side with the Egyptians and side against them. They can't operate openly. And so they created then these foils, these fronts by which to operate. One is the Levitical tradition, the so-called oral law that was handed down at Sinai to a council of elders, and the number 70 and 72 appears, which are all these solar cult numbers. And the oral law is nothing that is the same thing that turns up in the Talmud of later ages and of the Gaonim and the Levitical. And when people start finding out what this is all about and why there was 12 tribes of Israel, not 5, 15, 24, 12, which is the old Egyptian a mystery cult number, the story becomes incredible to discover that it's almost like those Chinese dolls.
Right. Not the Chinese, the stack dolls, the Russian stack dolls, you mean?
Yeah, so when Judaism as a trapping for Atomism was no longer working, it was a little too dry, a little too stolid, it was getting a lot of misinterpretations, it had fragmented too much, they wanted to jettison that capsule. Now, they weren't able to jettison it completely. They thought they were going to get rid of it utterly. It never completely disappeared. I mean, it's still around today. But the idea was to have a bright, brand new Christmas-wrapped religion that will be so ancient. You know, it's based on all the ancient sung cults that, Fraser goes into in the Golden Bough, and all the scholars have studied all that Mithraism and Agni going back to India. It was all going to be based on solar religion, yeah. But they wanted to have a new capsule to frame their Atomism. Atomism would basically be the main ingredient in it. Even though, in order to attract the world's attention, it would have lots of other elements thrown in as well. Because now you had to work in a hybrid way. You weren't the kings anymore, and you couldn't just say, that will be done, this is the way it's going to be. You tried that once, and it didn't work. So the Atomists got too smart for that. Plus, they were more modern also. As time elapsed and they moved into the West, they also had a sort of, new approach to be doing things. But what we know, in short, as Christianity, it is nothing more than Atomism, in my opinion, and I can prove it. It's very clear when you see the evidence. I mean, people have got to drop their prejudices and look with clean eyes.
Right.
If they do, they're going to see some remarkable thing. And it is dominating the world now, and because of the psychology that's behind sun worship, it has led to some very, very great breaches and atrocities, because there is a properties of light. Lucifer is named Lucifer for a reason, the light bringer, the light bearer for a reason. There are certain properties that are known in occultism of light that most of these people are not aware of. And light is being used in our society today as a weapon, and has been for a long, long time. And we need to understand all the different permutations of light and what Luciferianism really is.
Now, do you go into this in great detail in your newest book?
Yes, and people, if they go onto the Taroscopes website, and I'll tell you how to get to that, you can either go to taroscopes.com, and then you'll see these links called Astrotheology. If people go to the Astrotheology links, they will see excerpts of the new book. If people don't know how to spell or get onto the, I know you'll have links on your page, but people can just go to michaeltessarian.com, and then you'll find that is a navigation page to Taroscopes and all the other websites I have. So they can just go to michaeltessarian.com, click through to Taroscopes, and then go to the Astrotheology pages where all the the excerpts of the book are being presented every day. So the book itself will be out like in the early summer,
I'll be looking for it. Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'll make sure I send you, a free copy.
I would totally appreciate that. I'll give you my address when we're done. Meanwhile, we can assume that a lot of the powers that are behind the scenes, that are controlling the show, that hold most of the resources and chips in their hands are from from the Aton line. And so
yeah.
Then can we also assume that those who are not, who are bringing new information forward, who are stepping out of the box and choosing to wake up, might be of the, just to simplify things a bit, of the what you refer to as the Homo Atlantis line, or those who are beginning to wake up and who rebelled against all of that. Is that, at least in part, true, that many of us are starting to wake up?
Yes, there are, because remember, again, challenge always wakes people up, and there always has been another strain operating in this world. One of the reasons that the cult of Aton was so surreptitious is because they knew that all over the world there was other rival cults. not only these Lemurians that you're talking about, they knew they were out there. And in fact, those guys had even been a presence in Egypt itself. So, you know, but they also knew that there's lots and lots of other rival cults out there that are into goddess worship and into all other kinds of things. So, you know, and they're going to be on your trail. They're not going to let you rule so easily again. So in the last, since the Roman times, the cult of Apollon have been systematically erasing, smashing, and destroying all those rival cults, including the Druids. The Druids were the rival cult in Ireland, and they were destroyed. But the list of destroyed cults and destroyed sects and destroyed priestarchies who would have rivaled the Atenism and never believed in their one-sided, skewed philosophy have been systematically annihilated. That includes Gnostic groups, that includes Essenic groups, Judaic groups. We're talking about a wholesale, gradual, but deliberate slaughter of everyone who stood in the way of these Atenists. They do it very, very gradually. And that's how they co-opted power. It hasn't been like Lucky Luciano and his mafia boss gang just taking over New York. This is a very, very methodical movement of people who have been behind the Habsburgs, behind the Hanoverians, behind the Merovingian dynasty, the Carolingian dynasty, the Windsor family, you know, and of course their onslaught on America is a whole other subcategory of the study of how America was fell to these people through the skull and bones and through the...
To ask you about that. That seems to be where it's landed.
Yes, because these skull and bones is, again, these are, you know, not that the symbol itself is negative, but the terminology, the imagery, the idea that the same old Atenists and Templars and the Masonic orders, all Masons, all Templars, and I show stuff in my book on these things that nobody else has ever discovered, because, you know, we're still in the early days of understanding what these Templars and Masons are doing in the American soil. It's only been in the last 15, 20 years since the work of people like Eustace Mullins and G. Edward Griffin that Americans have even woken up to the fact that there is secret societies operating in their wonderful country, and that it's not operating as a democracy. And if people haven't found out before, they certainly know that now with the latest dynasty that's been in there, that something is seriously wrong, you know, in the corridors of power. Well, yeah, but it's not just located, or you're not just going to trace it back to the Bohemian society, you see, and the Skull and Bones in such a simple way. You got to realize that the Skull and Bones is connected to the Russell Trust. The Russell Trust is connected to the royal dynasties of England. You know, that the Council on Foreign Relations that basically controls America is connected directly to the Royal Institute of International Affairs, to the Cecil Rhodes' Roundtable Organization, to the elite of the British government. I mean, talking about, you know, the royalty there, the people who are behind the Windsors and Boris Leon family, Mountbatten or Battenberg family. You're talking about Saxe-Coburgs from Germany and from Belgium, the Stuart line. And Stuart is a corruption of the word steward, like a steward on a ship.
Mm-hmm.
And a steward is a placeholder. The word steward means I don't rule myself. I hold the throne, or I hold the reign in place of the one who is really the ruler.
Mm-hmm.
This exemplifies exactly what I mean when I say that people as powerful as the Stuart dynasty, and believe me, these people haven't gone anywhere, they're still around incognito, but they're all, in their own mythology, they're telling you that, oh yeah, yeah, we rule, but we rule in the place of the real rulers who don't want to dirty their hands. We are given our rights. And that's why they'll jump through a lot of hoops and do all sorts of crazy things, because they know the privilege that they've been given. So through these lieutenants, and I explain all about all these different lieutenant organizations, you know, they got into America. They lost. When they tried to fight with force of arms, they lost. But these people don't just give up because they've lost one type of fight. They can put in their agents, the people who assassinated Lincoln, the people who tried to take the life of Andrew Jackson, the people who put up the first Federal Reserve, all the people who were doing the shipping and the smuggling. These are the pirates, the buccaneers, and the privateers. You know, we're dealing here with an onslaught again that took a different form and came in through the economic destruction of America, and now you're seeing the symptoms. The thing is, 180 years takes a bit of time, but now you're seeing the chaos that you're seeing in the country is the concomitant or the symptom of a long and deliberate campaign of infiltration. And so that most of the people that you have now in the media and certainly in the think tanks, the education, and also in the government bodies, and the magazines and newspapers, are basically in league with, or are taking, as you said earlier, they're not maybe a lot of them conscious of this, because now you don't have to be conscious of it. The strings are being pulled. You know, you don't necessarily have to know you're on the strings.
Yes, very true.
My message is basically to people to realize, look, I'm not condemning anyone. I'm not interfering in the realm of personal worship. You know, I do not intrude into the personal religious space. But what I'm talking about is that there's institutions and bastions of great perfidy. They should never have got a foothold in the Americas, not just in North America, but in Canada and also in South America. But they have been able to do that. And therefore, there's no need for panic or for any kind of pessimism. This is a subject, a study like any other, and it's a fascinating one. I believe that, you know, history as a subject is not particularly fascinating, but the study of how history has been manipulated is a vastly interesting subject. And, you know, I find that a lot of people agree. You know, there's a whole MySpace generation that's slowly getting into this again, which is good to see amongst the youth, that they're open to these kinds of things as long as it's presented in a way that they can understand. Most people have understood 9/11, as bad as that incident was in a positive way, it was a catharsis so that people get a handle, wake up from the delirium a little bit. Because one of the strategies to keep people dumbed down, of course, is the old carrot, you know, keep people happy, keep them rich, keep them apathetic and privileged and all of this kind of thing. And then slowly people start to, you know, fall asleep.
Yes, and speaking of sleep, you have in your book toward the end, in the chapter called Time to Change the Road You're On, there's this one particular paragraph that I alluded to earlier that I really like. Do you mind if I read it?
Not at all. I'd be proud to have that.
Okay, and it says, when the sleepers awaken and make a return to Earth, a great cycle of time closes. Men and women return to the human, as opposed to the alien, within themselves, becoming their own priests and priestesses. The separation between the microcosm and the macrocosm passes away forever, like a shadow in the architecture of a nightmare, and the true renaissance of humankind begins. That's beautifully put, and that I relate to very strongly. I think we're all part of this, in that we're all trying to reflect new information out there, people doing this kind of work anyway. And I think there are many, 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 many people we would have never guessed even 10 years ago who are now starting to look this way for information, and they're
That's
beginning
right.
to wake up. So how do you see this going then? Is this an optimistic statement from you?
Yeah, always, because, you know, I'm like a, they say you can be a pessimist about tomorrow, but you can be an optimist about the day after tomorrow, and that's basically the way I am.
Yes.
Yeah, and from a spiritual point of view, you know, there's no way that any kind of evil can ever last forever, because by the very fact that it is evil, it's on a countdown to destruction.
Yes.
It doesn't have any sustainability. I mean, people should never forget this. The fact that something is evil, the fact that something is waving a flag in nature's face going, come and destroy me because I'm out of sync, should give you the greatest happiness to know that this thing is terminal. It cannot live because it is not of truth, it is not of justice, it is not of virtue. And believe me, nothing that is not virtuous, just, or truthful can survive. It can hang around for a while and it can make a lot of mess while it exists. It can, you know, it can botch things up a lot as it's done, but in the greater spectrum of life, it cannot, you know, persist. It just cannot happen because nature takes care of that kind of thing. Nature comes in and rectifies through its own mysterious ordinances any kind of injustice. What I'd like to see happen, my only message is, let's get with that force. Don't think that you're rowing, you know, the river is taking you where you need to go, but it would be nice to, you know, enjoy the ride as well. And it would be a good thing to participate in this process, because it's a very great work in life is to instruct fellow human beings and to, you know, think of the greater welfare, and also to combat any kind of injustice that exists. You can call it evil, you can not call it evil. I just call it lack of virtue. I call it immorality, and I call it injustice. And it's very, very important not to sit back. And therefore, when I wrote that line, I had Conrad Lorenz's, the great anthropologist, you know, I had his quote in mind that he said that, you know, human beings are the missing link between apes and human beings. Man is the missing link, he said, between apes and human beings.
Yes.
So, or that Gandhi had said, yeah, civilization would be a good idea.
Yes. Very, very well put. Well, just to wrap it up then, in the short term you're a pessimist, in the long term you're an optimist. What do you think the short term, maybe perhaps more pessimistic view might look like for us for a little bit before we can then move into the final part, the optimistic view?
It comes back full circle to the beginning of our show, trauma. The people who are ruling the world, you know, doesn't matter what you call them, you know, we've described them as atomists and whatever, but even if you don't want to believe in all of that, let's just keep it that you've got evil men ruling the world. Those evil men use trauma. They traumatize you through the media, through, you know, incidents, these false flag operations like the 9/11, they may pull off some more of that, just with the idea, simple, you know, from their boardroom point of view, there's nothing dramatic about any of this, it's simple strategy, go and traumatize the herd, crack the whip, you know, keep those people frozen with fear, get them in lack, it's global warming, it's lack of money, the dollar's going to be destroyed, the banks are going to close, you know, come on, give them some panic, you know, bird flu, you know, paranoid society, microchipping, the kids are out of control, you know, this stuff that keeps coming across the media, you know, into your late life space, affects the limbic centers of the brain. So the most important thing to be looking for in the next couple of years is, one, there'll be a stepping up of this traumata generated from on high, which again will displace people who are not centered. And two, you have the problem that I deal with a lot in my other work about what I call the masks coming down. One of the other quote-unquote traumatic things that people might start to notice until they realize it's a positive thing, so don't be traumatized, is that you're going to have this phenomena of revelation taking place. It's already stepped up since November 8th of 2003, I believe. But, 2003, yeah. And now in 2007, with the operations of the planet Pluto, from now on, from 2007 till 2012, we're now in a cycle which is called, like, you know, a very important phase of the cycle of revelation.
Yes.
Or the cycle of revealing, or it's also called the age of awakening, you know. So there's going to be awakening to the duplicity of human beings. That means the people in your closest relationships, people that you work with, others, you're going to start seeing who these people really are. And this is going to be traumatic to protagonists who don't understand that this is okay. You want the mask to come down. We got to drop our stupid roles that people are playing and get back to dealing with each other on a person-to-person basis. And this is now what is happening, I believe, very, very importantly, is the two things. One, the government will try to offset spiritual development by a whole cocktail of barrage of different, you know, things that
fear,
they do.
Fear-inspiring tactics, yes.
Fear-inspiring tactics, more war, more lack, more sorrow, more terrorism, whatever. And, you know, I go into this in my DVDs, exactly the different lineaments of this. But another aspect is very, very important to never forget, and it involves consciousness and psychology, and that is that the people of truth are going to get more rational. They're going to be using their criticism abilities, critical ability, and judgmental abilities a lot more. They're going to be forced to do that. And they need to do it because around them, you know, all the different Judases and the people who don't have light and they don't have soul are going to start revealing themselves for who they are. It's another operation that's happening astrologically, astromantically. And therefore, my message is very much a message to not fear that, to let it happen. Do not try to prop these people up. Do not try to put the mask back on. And certainly do not lay down your life as a martyr for their cause. Step back, be objective, be loving, but watch what's happening and see it for a good thing. Difficult for Americans to grasp this because Americans by nature are very solar, they're very Jupiterian, they're very outgoing, and therefore they tended to slack off a little bit in understanding the psychological aspects of life. And now they're going to get an opportunity again, and I look at that as extremely positive. That's why I'm an optimist about the day after tomorrow, because nothing bad can ever come from a psychological, you know, understanding of what man himself is. So my work does not focus entirely, you see, on all of these external agencies of negativity, and people can, they'll be able to see that in the books that I write. I do deal with that, and I think it's interesting, but to me, it's all about who man is within himself. What did man do to be so afflicted? Man must have done something in his consciousness, you know, or man might be still doing something in his consciousness to allow himself to be dominated. So, you know, in one of the talks that I do, I put it this way. You can either say, you know, have I been sold a lie? That's one way you can, you know, phrase the problems of your life, or you can also rephrase it in a more proactive way and say, have I bought a lie?
Right.
And when you say, have I bought a lie, as opposed to have somebody sold me a lie, now you're actually in, you know, just it's a little tweak on the idea.
Then you're empowered again.
But you're empowered to do something about it because you realize it's your business.
Right.
And then when you're that way empowered, that has all the psychological difference in the world from everyone bringing you up to believe that everybody else is at fault. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do, and I couldn't agree more with you in terms of your assessment, and in the end, I often say the same thing. We are in the time of revelations. Revelations is now, and just the fact that people like yourself are out there doing your work and are revealing a new face to our history as a species is a very, very important aspect of this event. This is a good thing. So, gosh, I hope we can speak again. I hope I'm hoping actually to maybe hook up with you at some point and get you on video with me as well, if we can be in the same city at the same time. And if not, can we do this again?
Yes, that'd be no problem. Yeah, I'm traveling a lot, so, you know, but I definitely do want to do some more, so yeah.
Okay, absolutely. Very good. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has just been incredible. And I'm anxious to read your new book, and everybody will be able to go to this page and link on your site and delve into your work. I thought your book, Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation, was brilliant. So, Michael, thank you for everything that you do.
Thank you. It'll be the new book's 2 volumes, and I'll definitely have, it'll be coming through your mailbox in the summertime.
Okay, very good. Well, we'll sign off, and I'll give you my address.
Thank you, dear.
Michael's website at michaeltesarion.com. That's Michael, and his last name is spelled TSARION.com, which will take you into all of the links mentioned earlier in this interview. Meanwhile, I look forward to the release of his new book, and we will continue our conversations with Michael at that time. Until next time, thanks for listening.